The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
What I think people have been looking for, again, from sort of the civil society perspective, from the private sector perspective, from the media perspective, and from the public's perspective, are a few sort of big picture areas where the public or these different groups would like to see more clarity. The first is clarity in the law. And it sounds sort of very fundamental and very basic, but it's actually really important, and it's important both in the U.S. and it's also important to the international community. So the clarity in the law, what I mean by that is the ability for a informed observer to understand what laws mean when they authorize intelligence activities or surveillance activities in particular, which has been the focus of so much of the attention. And so that speaks to laws being clear about what they affirmatively authorize and the laws being public law, that they are passed by the legislature, that they are there for everyone to see.
I'm Cody Poplin, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, May 28th, 2016. That was the voice of Carrie Cordero, Lawfare contributor and former Justice Department official, discussing the importance of transparency and legal authorities for intelligence programs. This week, the American Bar Association hosted a panel discussion on achieving more transparency about secret intelligence programs, which, along with Carrie, featured comments from Alexander Joel of ODNI and Rachel Brand of the PCLOB. The panel explores recent calls for greater transparency and examines whether the recently adopted principles go far enough. Can an entity oriented towards secrecy by nature operate effectively in an environment of transparency? And just how much more transparent can intelligence agencies be? It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode number 172, The Role of Transparency in Intelligence Programs.
Thank you, LaToya, and thanks to everyone for joining us. I'm Rachel Brand. I serve as co-chair of the ABA Administrative Law Section's Subcommittee on Government Information and Right to Privacy, and I will moderate this discussion in that capacity. I also currently serve as a member of the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board. I should make clear that to the extent I express any views today, they are my own. I don't speak for the ABA, the PCLOB, or anyone else. The subject of the conversation this afternoon is how to achieve more transparency about secret intelligence programs. This is a hard and important subject. Transparency is a fundamental value in American government. It enables accountability and democratic control. And in most areas of government, we can and should have a very high degree of transparency. But when it comes to intelligence programs, that need for transparency runs headlong into a legitimate need for secrecy. Intelligence programs rely on some degree of secrecy in order to operate effectively. The hard question is where to draw that line between secrecy and transparency. The U.S. intelligence community has undertaken a number of transparency initiatives over the last several years, but there continue to be calls for more and different information about what the agencies are doing and how specific intelligence programs affect Americans and citizens of other countries. We have two speakers this afternoon who are highly qualified to talk about this issue. I'll introduce both of them, and they will each offer opening remarks. Then we'll ask them some questions, and then finally we'll open it up to the audience for questions, and we'll end at 4 o'clock. Our first speaker will be Alex Joel. Alex has served since 2005 as a Civil Liberties Protection Officer for the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. He leads the ODNI's Civil Liberties and Privacy Office and advises the Director of National Intelligence. He's responsible for ensuring that privacy and civil liberties protections are incorporated into intelligence community policy, for overseeing compliance by the ODNI with privacy and civil liberties laws, for reviewing complaints of possible abuses of privacy and civil liberties in programs and operations administered by the ODNI. Prior to joining ODNI, Mr. Joel served in the CIA General Counsel's Office, was the Privacy, Technology, and E-Commerce Attorney for Marriott International, practiced law at the law firm Shaw, Pittman, Potts, and Trowbridge, and was a U.S. Army Judge Advocate General Corps Officer. Mr. Joel graduated from the University of Michigan Law School and Princeton University. Our second speaker will be Carrie Cordero. Ms. Cordero owns a law and advisory practice focusing on national security law, homeland security law, and related privacy, cybersecurity, and data protection issues. She's an adjunct law professor at Georgetown, where previously she served as the Director of National Security Studies. Ms. Cordero's government service includes serving as counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for National Security, as Senior Associate General Counsel at the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, as Attorney Advisor in the Department of Justice, and as a Special Assistant U.S. Attorney. Ms. Cordero is a prolific speaker and writer on national security issues, both in the mainstream press and scholarly publications. I frequently read her commentary on Lawfare. She's an elected director of the Bar Association of the District of Columbia and a certified information privacy professional. She graduated from the Washington College of Law at American University and from Barnard College. So with those introductions out of the way, Alex, Joel, let's start with you.
Thank you very much, Rachel, and I really appreciate the opportunity to speak about transparency. It's something that has been very much consuming a lot of my time. I'm also, in addition to being the Civil Liberties Protection Officer, the DNI has designated me to be the ODNI's Transparency Officer, and we are trying to coordinate our intelligence community across the board in figuring out how best to draw that line, as you put it, Rachel, between secrecy and transparency. We do recognize the importance of enhancing transparency in terms of public trust and accountability, as you pointed out, Rachel, in your opening remarks. But at the same time, we have to balance that very carefully with our legal and moral obligation to protect sources and methods. As I've said before, a fully transparent intelligence service will be fully ineffective. And so that question about where to draw that line between secrecy and transparency is a difficult one to answer. It depends on the circumstances, and there are a variety of challenges associated with doing it in the intelligence context. But we are working hard to do that, and we've already accomplished a few things. So, for example, some of the listeners may know that we have established IC on the Record, which is a Tumblr platform, a Tumblr site, on which we have published thousands of pages of declassified documents and official statements, speeches, and other testimony. So if you guys haven't looked at that already, you really should. It's icontherecord.tumblr.com. And on there you'll find not only these declassified documents and reports and statements, but also other information about the intelligence community. Rachel, as you know, we've worked closely with the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board as it's conducted its oversight activities, including two in-depth and very detailed reports about different Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act programs that have been carried out by the intelligence community. Those reports were hundreds of pages long and were wholly unclassified and made public, and that involved an intensive effort across the community to review that information and make declassification determinations as appropriate so that the board could publish those documents. We have, in addition, supported the passage of the USA Freedom Act. This is a statute that passed in 2015 that modified various authorities, and one of the things that it included was a requirement or transparency-related requirements. And one of those requirements, for example, was to review for declassification and release Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court opinions, and we recently released some of those. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court had previously also had us conduct declassification reviews to release other opinions, which they posted on their website. So a range of Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court opinions have recently been published. In addition, we recently published a transparency report setting forth some of the statistics involved with the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. One of the other things that we have been doing is engaging closely with civil society. These are the groups, the advocacy organizations on topics of interest to them, and we are going to continue to do that going forward. I think these engagements can be very helpful in enhancing mutual understanding and us hearing directly from the advocacy community what is of interest to them. So just to quickly, just to lay the groundwork for some of the documents that we have that govern this area, in February of 2015, the DNI published the Principles of Intelligence Transparency for the Intelligence Community. You can find this document by going to dni.gov. If you navigate to the bottom of the page, you'll see a link for transparency, and it'll take you to these principles. There's basically, you know, it's a one-page document, fairly easy to read, even though lawyers, as usual, played a hand in drafting this. So we as lawyers suffer from the challenge of speaking plain English. But there are basically four principles. And the first one talks about providing appropriate transparency to enhance public understanding of the intelligence community and really focuses on two general areas. One are, you know, what is our mission and what are we doing to accomplish it? And the other is focused on what are the laws and other rules that govern our activities, how are we complying with that, and what is the oversight structure for that. So I call that the what of transparency. What are we trying to be transparent about? The second principle is the how of transparency. It directs us to be proactive and clear in making information publicly available. And again, it highlights some areas. One is we have to focus on matters of the public interest. We have to be clear and provide appropriate context. We need to take advantage and use other forms of technology to make the information available to meet the public essentially where they are, which for our right now what we're focusing on is better enhancing our website presence, making it easier to navigate, using blogs like Tumblr, and figuring out how to better leverage social media to highlight information that has been disclosed through these channels. And then, of course, engaging with civil society is another element of that, which I've already discussed. The third principle I call the but still, which is we still have to protect information about intelligence sources, methods, and activities as necessary to protect national security. And in this section three, this third principle does highlight principles and provisions in our existing classification documentation and guidance, which is aligned with our goals for transparency. I won't get into the details of that, but we're really there trying to point out that the classification guidance we're operating under, if carefully and diligently followed and consistently applied, will in fact enhance transparency, which may be counterintuitive for some folks. And then the last principle is really what I call the just do it principle, which is align our roles and resources and processes to support transparency implementation. And that's the phase that we're currently in, which is that principle four. Pursuant to that, in the fall of last year, we published an implementation plan, which is can be found by clicking on that same link, which really focuses on how do we make transparency a durable and institutionalized part of the IC. We really want to make transparency more consistent, coordinated, credible, and sustainable. So if you look at that implementation plan, it was drafted by representatives from across the IC. The DNI asked me to do that with an interagency effort. The people working on that at the time were called the Intelligence Transparency Working Group. We have now chartered that group into an Intelligence Transparency Council that meets periodically to make sure that we are executing the implementation plan. And in that plan, you'll see a range of initiatives. I won't go into them in detail right now, but I will highlight them to the extent that it's helpful for the public discussion, for this discussion today. I would say that this is not an easy thing for the intelligence community to do. We are sort of structured and designed and built and trained, and our policies and processes are put in place really to accomplish the mission of intelligence, which involves protecting the sources and methods we use to make ourselves, to ensure that we're effective in carrying out that national security mission. And so there's a lot of work done in the intelligence community around securing valuable and sensitive information from disclosure to unauthorized folks, And what we have to do with transparency is build that in as well so that intelligence professionals understand that part of our obligation is to the public, to the American people specifically, and the public more generally, to make sure that we are providing the information needed in a democratic society. So that is a challenging thing to do, and drawing that line between a necessary secret and appropriate transparency is what we're engaged in right now. Thanks.
All right, thank you, Alex. Carrie Cordero, your reactions or any whatever you want to say affirmatively first.
Thanks, Rachel. This is Carrie Cordero, and thanks, Rachel, and to the ABA for organizing this call, and for Alex Joltz for participating from the ODNI perspective. This is a really important issue, and I think it's worth, I'll just sort of back up a little bit from the specifics that Alex gave regarding the efforts that he's been leading at the DNI's office and with the intelligence community to implement transparency. I think it's worth noting that I think there's a broader conversation about transparency that's going on about government activities more generally. And it was interesting, there was an article just in the Washington Post this morning, interestingly in the style section, which I couldn't figure out why, but there was an interesting article that was talking about government transparency more broadly. And from the media perspective, there's been a lot of criticisms about sort of the lack of transparency about government activities. And so I think it's important to distinguish between sort of those criticisms that have been levied against the administration in particular and the executive branch more generally about transparency about overall U.S. government activities versus what we're getting at in this call, which is focused specifically on the intelligence community. So that was just sort of one broader distinction that I wanted to make, because I think there's a difference between that broader discussion about transparency about government activities more broadly versus the issues that are very specific to the intelligence community. I'll spend just a couple minutes highlighting from an objective perspective what I think outside advocates, the media, the academic community have been looking to the intelligence community to do over the last, in particularly the last few years, to focus on transparency. And then hopefully later on, perhaps through the Q&A, I can get to where I think we're headed, and more specifically, some additional areas that I'd like to see more work be done in the transparency area. So first, what I think people have been looking for, again, from sort of the civil society perspective, from the private sector perspective, from the media perspective, and from the public's perspective, are a few sort of big picture areas where the public or these different groups would like to see more clarity. The first is clarity in the law. And it sounds sort of very fundamental and very basic, but it's actually really important, and it's important both in the U.S. and it's also important to the international community. And we can hopefully get to a little bit issues with respect to the international community and the interest that they have in transparency in intelligence activities as well. So the clarity in the law, what I mean by that is the ability for a informed observer to understand what laws mean when they authorize intelligence activities or surveillance activities in particular, which has been the focus of so much of the attention. And so that speaks to laws being clear about what they affirmatively authorize, and the laws being public law, that they are passed by the legislature, that they are there for everyone to see. And the fact that the laws are understandable in particular to members of Congress who might be considering legislative proposals or prior interpretations of the law. The second, in relation to sort of clarity about what the laws are then clarity in legal interpretations. And so this is where a lot of work has been done. Alex mentioned the release of FISA court opinions. Obviously, a lot more has been released in the last couple of years. Now the USA Freedom Act provides for more disclosure of those opinions. But it has been a very important goal of those seeking more transparency to have more clarity in what FISA court opinions are and what executive branch interpretations of what the laws are. So I think public law, clarity in legal interpretation. Those are two foundational issues that are particularly important to the academic community, to the scholarly community, perhaps less so to the public at large, but through the academic community and the media, the release of that information then helps inform the public more about what is both authorized and how those laws are then being implemented. Another area that we've seen a lot of focus in over the last couple years in response to criticisms of lack of transparency has been the area of statistics. So numbers about how many applications are filed in particular matters. And then the annual public number, for example, of Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court applications, that has been public for many, many years, and that annual public number has been released. But there has been a push, and so now there is more information that is released regarding more detailed statistics, not just how many applications are filed and modified or approved or rejected, but information that the private sector can release regarding how they are complying with government requests for information. And so these are in the form of transparency reports that private sector companies, often communication companies, receive, and then they are able to publish these reports so that they can inform their consumers and customers about their compliance. This statistical reporting, which was the result of significant negotiation, the possible threat of litigation even between the government and the private sector, is a significant change from prior practice. And as just one example, you know, there different companies include publish their transparency reports. They include statistics about national security, letter compliance, law enforcement requests, FISA court orders, and now those statistics are broken down in terms of even down to the details of ranges of numbers of individuals that were affected or accounts that are being affected. You know, perhaps we can talk more as we get into the question and answer as to sort of what the how valuable those are. I think the perspective from the private sector is that it, particularly following unauthorized disclosures, it was very important to these companies to be able to release that type of information publicly. It's an interesting change from sort of historically the relationship between companies that comply with national security orders and the government and the public. Historically, the companies that were in receipt of information, first of all, orders were classified. They weren't able to release that type of information publicly. And frequently, companies were not particularly interested in that information being public. We now, in the current day, are in a completely opposite situation, where now the private sector companies that are on the receiving end of court orders from the government are in a position where they feel that for various business and marketing reasons, they need to be able to release that type of information to give confidence and to have trust with their customers and clients. So we've seen a real shift in terms of the desire on the part of the private sector to align with advocacy organizations in order to pressure the government, frankly, into enabling the release of many more statistics than we previously had seen. So in addition to law, legal interpretation, statistics, there's also obviously been increased interest in clarity and policies, and I think this is the area where the efforts that Alex described in terms of developing the privacy, transparency, the transparency principles, and the implementation of those transparency principles is obviously an important component in being able to enable transparency for intelligence community policies and sort of how things get done. Alex mentioned a few of the transparency initiatives that have taken place. I'd add a few that are, I think, also notable, particularly in comparison to the United States' efforts to increase transparency with respect to the intelligence community. So obviously the discussion over transparency has not just been an issue in the United States, it's been part of a global conversation about intelligence activities and surveillance in particular. And so it's notable that the United States Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court has its own website. The court's rules are public. There's now information that pertains to the court's docket and matters that are filed before the court that are on the website. The FISA annual public report is accessible there. Alex mentioned the IC website, the Privacy Civil Liberties Oversight Board. In addition to the reports that the board issues, the board has held numerous public hearings. And then again, I would just mention the private sector, the shift towards the private sector disclosures, which has been a big shift, I think, in terms of what we've seen in efforts that the government has made to facilitate transparency. So I think I'll pause there, and then Rachel, I'll turn it back over to you to go from there.
Thank you, Carrie. I first want to turn it back over to Alex briefly to see, Alex, if you have anything that you'd like to say in response to Carrie's comments.
I just want to point out that she's right about the global context of this. So by definition, anything that we make available to the American public, to whom we are ultimately accountable, is going to, by its nature, be public for the entire world. So that's obviously something in our minds. We are focused on, public transparency with this, with these transparency initiatives, and so the global context in which this takes place is important. And we have been engaged in discussions with folks in other countries, and some of them are certainly taking notice of our transparency here. It is very difficult for, as I mentioned at the start, for an intelligence service of any country to get into the public transparency area. The typical posture of intelligence agencies is the less said about us, the better. And so for any intelligence service to be proactively seeking to find ways to provide more information, it is a shift. I think it's an important shift, and it's a good shift, and it's one that our leadership firmly embraces. But it is something that has taken some adjusting.
Thank you. Let me probe on that a little bit. So the IC has adopted transparency principles. You issued a transparency implementation plan. You referred earlier in your opening remarks to a working group or a committee that's engaged to deal with this. But how does that happen in practice? How does the rubber meet the road? Because principles and an implementation plan, it's all at a very high level of generality. It sounds good. It's got good platitudes in it. But how do you actually in practice nudge the agencies to release more information? Who's doing it? Is it just your office that's focusing on it, or are folks throughout the agencies expected to also implement? Can you talk us through that? And I'd like to get Carrie's reaction about to that as well.
Right. So it is an IC-wide initiative. I'd say first and foremost, the thing that is very important to have is senior leadership support. And the Director of National Intelligence, Jim Clapper, along with senior leadership across the intelligence community, has really embraced the need for enhancing intelligence transparency. And they see that there's an important role to be played in better informing the public about who we are, what we do, what our rules are, how we comply with the rules, how oversight is conducted. That's critically important for a balanced public discussion, for public trust and public accountability. So absolutely important is to have that senior leadership buy-in, but you also need buy-in across the agency. So one of the things that I have been doing and our folks here and have been doing is communicating internally to make sure that our workforce understands what we're doing and to hear the concerns that they may have regarding what we're engaged in. And so as an example, I meet with our workforce. I've done sessions with them where essentially I show up, I tell them there's no attribution, I'm not taking notes, there's no PowerPoint. I'm here just to hear anything that's on their mind, any concerns they may have about civil liberties and transparency and what they're reading in the news or anything like that. And I hear from the workforce that they're focused on transparency, and so there's a general understanding that given today's day and age where we are today, the expectation really is that we have to be more provide more information to the public. One of the things that happens when you have senior leadership support and buy-in from the agencies is that the worst thing we can do here as a centralized basis is get in the way. What we want to do is make sure that everyone understands what the processes and procedures are, and that we're exercising, that we're doing things in a responsible and coordinated way. So we're really trying to focus on making sure that coordination is working smoothly, and that people understand who the experts are that need to be consulted on any particular matter, so that we can decide in a responsible way how to make something public. But there's a lot of stuff that's going on at all levels to do that. So as an example, we have joined the FOIA pilot under which we are publishing the information we release under FOIA. So typically under the Freedom of Information Act, the information being released goes directly to the requester, and it's really up to the requester to decide whether or not they'll publish it. We have decided that we will, and then if there was always a policy that we would, you know, frequently requested documents would be posted on the website, we have taken the view that except on rare exceptions, we are going to proactively publish the information being requested under FOIA. Similarly, we have written and published reports under the Presidential Policy Directive 28 on signals intelligence, the policies under those reports. We have learned a lot regarding how to review documents carefully that come out of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, or reports that are made under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And all of that takes a lot of time. And so one of the other things we're doing is just learning lessons and trying to document those lessons in our internal processes, so that as we go through an exercise of an interagency coordination and review of a particular kind of document for public release, we're trying to figure out ways to make sure that we capture what we learned in that process, so that we can do it better going forward. But there are plenty of challenges and issues along the way, as I alluded to a couple times now. This is not something that is the intuitive natural function of an intelligence service. So it is something that is taking us time and time to get right.
Thanks, Alex. Carrie, is there anything you'd like to add on that?
I'll just sort of make two quick points. So one, just going back for a second to the global issues. Obviously, this has been sort of a global conversation regarding surveillance. And from that perspective, I think the U.S. has really been way out ahead in terms of its transparency, both in terms of public law that we have, the publication of procedures, documents like PPD 28, the Presidential Policy Directive on Signals Intelligence that was issued recently. So I think the U.S. has been way out ahead in terms of communicating publicly what it is doing and releasing a lot of information about how it conducts surveillance in particular. Europe is slowly, and when I say Europe, I mean sort of the EU is slowly moving in this direction, and I say slowly because it's only recently that we've even seen reports written that sort of describe what it is that member states, EU member states, actually do in terms of their surveillance laws and capabilities. There was a recent report by the Fundamental Rights Agency that was commissioned by the EU, and that report is very helpful. There's a couple others that have been like it, but there is far more information available that has been released both by the DNI, by Congress, by the PCLOB, than what I am under the understanding as is available from EU member states' perspective. If there's anyone on the call who knows more about sort of transparency that's available from individual EU member states, I certainly would be interested in hearing about it. But that, at least, is my perspective as of now. Shifting a little bit to sort of what the challenges are in terms of implementation and getting to your question to Alex, I think the big challenge for the intelligence community is figuring out how to do meaningful transparency. In other words, there's been a lot of call to release opinions and release documents. And I think the challenge is figuring out what is it that the intelligence community can release that actually is going to be meaningful, that can, that is in the public interest, that will inform the public and sort of constituencies of interest in learning about the intelligence community activities. And so the meaningful piece, I think, requires a lot of thought, and it's not just a matter of declassifying as much as the government possibly can. So one area that I have written about a little bit in terms of what I think would be meaningful transparency pertains not so much to legal opinions, but pertains and sort of government policies, but pertains to the substance of what the intelligence community learns that informs policymakers about world events. And for example, information about counterterrorism threats would be an example of that. We see a little bit of it in terms of the DNI's annual threat assessment when he testifies and writes a report before Congress that's declassified, but I think it would be worth considering from the intelligence community perspective if there's other things that can't be done from the leadership perspective that would provide more substantive understanding so that Americans have a better understanding of where the $50 billion that funds the intelligence community goes.
Well, let me follow up on that a little bit and follow up on a question that I think you invited during your opening remarks, which is about statistics. You're talking about meaningful transparency. To what extent do you think statistics provide meaningful transparency? I think in your opening remarks you invited a question about whether that is valuable. What do you think those statistics tell you? The stats that are out there now, what do you think they tell you or tell us? And are there other statistics that could be more valuable that you think the IC could release without damaging the national security?
So from my perspective, so the statistics that I think we've seen that are new that are released are examples in what the providers release regarding their compliance with government requests for information. From industry's perspective, what we know about industry's perspective, particularly the technology community, they view the release of those statistics as important to inform their customers and to rebuild trust that they believe was damaged as a result of unauthorized disclosures. From my perspective, I don't find the release of statistics as persuasive in terms of being released. And my own view, having spent a decade working with the intelligence community, is that the information about which providers are served with orders is perhaps some of the most damaging information that can be released from a national security perspective. Obviously, the executive branch took that into account and made a decision, whether one would characterize that decision as a political decision, an economic decision, a strategic judgment, or all of those put together to agree to enable the publication of those statistics. But and I would add that the intelligence community has not been willing to articulate whether or how the release of that information is damaging. They've taken the position that the way that they've negotiated the releases, which right now, if folks on the call are not familiar, is sort of in terms of numerical ranges. So a particular company, for example, I'm looking at Microsoft's transparency report from the first half of 2015, and Microsoft reveals that there were orders in the range of 0 to 499 that impacted between 15,500 and 15,999 accounts. I don't particularly personally feel that that is so informative, but from Microsoft's perspective, it seems to be.
Okay, Alex, let me turn that over to you for a little bit of a different twist, which is the government's release of statistics. You are required under the USA Freedom Act to release some statistics, for example, about Section 702, which you have done. The PCLOB asked the IC to consider releasing different categories of numbers on related to 702. You've done some of that in the USA Freedom Act releases, and with respect to other measures that we recommended, you haven't done it, and you've expressed that it's difficult, but you're working to get to a place where you can do more. Can you talk a little bit about why it's so difficult to release more numbers, and whether you think those numbers, either both the ones that have been released and the ones that may be released in the future, add value from a transparency perspective?
Yeah, so this is obviously a big issue in the public discussion right now, and we are engaged in discussions with, you know, with multiple folks about it, including with, you know, in continued engagements with civil society, trying to discuss what it is that we can say and why, and hopefully be able to explain why it is we are having trouble saying getting into additional levels of specificity. I mean, as a general matter, there are technical reasons why it's difficult, for example, to be able to count. I think one of the big issues on statistics is really counting the U.S. incidentally conducted communications involving Americans or lawful permanent residents or U.S. corporations or U.S. associations. That's the definition of a U.S. person. To count them when you're targeting somebody who is a non-U.S. person overseas to collect foreign intelligence under Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, you know, inevitably some of those collections will involve communications with U.S. persons, and, you know, why is it difficult for us to count that? So we're trying to get to a point where we can better explain that, and we're exploring different alternatives and proxies for that. So we're not in a position yet where I can describe that in more detail, but that's been something we're focused on. It can be very hard, you know, for example, if you have to do research and actually try to figure out if a particular communicant is or is not an American, then, by doing that research, you are now getting into a level of detail about a particular individual that previously would not have been something that we would have done. So there is a privacy component to it. I think in our discussions, people are recognizing that and thinking about other ways that we can do this and that would also protect privacy. So that's really where we are. I want to quickly address, and I'll just point out another complexity that we have is that we, you know, for example, we've now published three annual reports. Two of them we did without a requirement in the law that we do so, and so we wrote those based on, you know, other considerations. And then the third was really conforming to the requirements and the language in the USA Freedom Act. And I think one of the unintended, one of the lessons we've learned in that is that the way the legislative wording, which we're required to follow for that statistical reporting, is different in ways that, you know, can be very nuanced and subtle from how we were otherwise already doing this. And so we had to look at that language and think about it and figure out how to apply it. So that maybe led to some complexities that we hadn't anticipated. I'll say generally in terms of priorities, that is something that we recognize that we have to do. It's in the implementation plan that we have to come up with common criteria for how do we identify a topic. I agree with Carrie that we do want to provide meaningful transparency. We don't want to provide meaningless transparency. The way that I think of it is generally, you know, I think this is just me informally noodling this. I think of a chart basically with the vertical scale being importance to achieving the transparency goals and the horizontal scale meaning being level of difficulty. And if you think about that and divide it into four quadrants in your upper left, you know, something that is very important and also not very difficult, you should just go ahead and do it now. Let's go ahead and start providing transparency on that. Unfortunately, most of the things that we want to focus on will be toward the right on the level of difficulty. And there, if it's important but difficult, you still want to do it, but it's going to take time and effort and planning, and you want to start getting into it as we have been with the FISA-related stuff. And obviously things that are below that the line in terms of importance, things that simply are not very meaningful, would not be prioritized. So we don't want to spend most of our time sort of what I think of as below the line. We want to be above the line, and there what we can accomplish will be based on how difficult it is to do it now versus doing it later.
Alex, one last question for you, and then we'll have time for a couple audience questions. One thing that I've written about is the difficulty in drawing the line between transparency and secrecy, because everyone would grant that law should be public as much as possible, and most people would also agree that sources and methods need to be protected. You, in your opening, referred to a legal and moral obligation to protect sources and methods. But where is the line between those two things? So if you have a set of minimization procedures governing the 702 program or some specific program, and you've decided you're going to release the minimization procedures as much as possible, but you're going to redact certain provisions, what damage specifically are you trying to avoid when you decide, okay, we're going to redact section 3B1 of the minimization procedures? How do you, just when the rubber meets the road, how are you making those decisions and what are you trying to avoid?
Well, let me just say, sir, at a general level, one of the reasons this is so hard is that the decisions need to be made in a very careful manner that involve the subject matter experts. And I'm talking not only the lawyers, which lawyers are involved in things like minimization procedures, of course, but very much also involving the operators, the people actually carrying out the activity, the people who are responsible for obtaining the intelligence, analyzing it, and reporting it. And so these are the people who have the best understanding of how exposing a particular piece of information might impact them by causing, for example, adversaries to alter their behavior and avoid detection through that particular method. And those are the same people. Those are the people you absolutely want at the table, and they're the same people who are actually responsible for doing the intelligence work. And so the burden on them can be quite significant, and so we have to always manage that at a general level. This is one of the reasons why it's so hard to do. You can't just sort of add, you know, newly hired people and throw them at the problem. You need to really bring in those subject matter experts. Whose time is limited, and beyond that, in terms of like the specific question you're getting at, sometimes the procedures, the legal procedures of implement a particular authority, get into a lot of detail. They'll say use this technique, if X, then Y. You get into a level of step by step processes that the concern is that if disclosed, people who are trying to evade surveillance by the NSA because they're planning a terrorist attack or something like that could look at that and say, ah, if X then Y, that means that we have to avoid looking like X, so that, you know, or we have to look like X, depending on what X and Y is. I'm sorry I'm being so cryptic, but generally speaking, sometimes the details can actually enable people to take action to avoid the effectiveness of the technique that we're talking about. But it's a tough issue, because if it is a procedure that implements a legal authority, we obviously have a priority on trying to make that public.
Okay. Well, there are about 10 minutes left on this call. If anyone in the audience has a question.
And your first question comes from the line of Andy Gonzalez.
Yes, this time Andy Gonzalez.
Go ahead.
I'm an attorney in New York who was interested in the very last question posed by the moderator, which is, where exactly do you draw the line? And that's my starting point for this whole inquiry. I wonder if there are any parties who disagree emphatically with the government's policy and with some of the lines that have been drawn to date in specific cases, and whether any such dissenting or radical parties on either side of the issue have been of any help to the process of drawing those lines. I understand that it's inherently difficult anyway, but I wonder to what extent there is useful dissent besides the very slight dissent that I've heard between the two panelists today.
Oh, there's a lot. There's Rachel, if you mind, don't mind, I'll take a first crack at it. There's a lot of vibrant discussion. I'm sure you'll hear from civil society folks that we are not being forward-leaning enough in terms of how we are providing transparency. and we hear and engage with those folks all the time. And internally, as I said, it's a cultural shift for the intelligence community. We have this decades long, well, as long as intelligence agencies have existed in around the world, there has been an obligation to keep sources and methods secret to protect them from unauthorized disclosure and in order to protect national security. So there are plenty of folks who raise concerns about releasing too much information, and as we go over documents carefully, there are plenty of voices who speak up and say this is a concern. We can't release this piece of information because if this piece of information is combined with these other pieces of information, it'll form a picture that a sophisticated adversary can then infer what the secret is that we're trying to protect. And I'll put in that the sophistication level, in my personal opinion, that's required to piece different things together has gone down over the last decades. You can now use, obviously anyone can use searches and then can put documents into databases and analyze them. And so the concern that pieces of information released over time by different places could inadvertently or unintentionally disclose something that is that the agencies have decided needs to be kept secret to protect sources and methods, that risk is definitely there, and we're reminded of it all the time.
Alex, just to follow up on the questioner's question, which is another way to look at it would be, does external dissent assist your thinking? So I know that the NSA specifically, I think, and perhaps other IC elements have convened sessions with folks from some of the advocacy, privacy advocacy and other advocacy organizations out there. There was a recent meeting up at NSA that some press came out of it. I assume you're doing that because you find that useful. I assume that you do it because it refines your thinking in some way. Can you elaborate on that?
Absolutely. I think it's very important, and we do those engagements. And we're doing it more frequently now than we ever have before. I do find it useful. I think it helps the advocates better understand what they're advocating about. I mean, they can better understand what our activities are. They can better understand the documents, what they mean as they read them. And I think I don't want to speak for them, but in my opinion, it would be helpful to them so that it can better focus what their priorities are for advocacy. And on our side, it's extremely helpful to hear from them and to get their views. They of course, advocate against some of the things and many of the things that we do. That's their mission and that's what they do. And it's helpful to have conversations with them where we can better understand where they're coming from. And sometimes, they're advocating about something which with more discussion and understanding, we can find another way of providing the information that they're really seeking that is underlying their concern. At least that's our hope.
If I can just jump in, I would sort of go a little bit further. This is Carrie, in terms of saying that external dissent played a dramatic role in terms of moving the community to where it is today in terms of transparency, specifically with respect to some of the private sector issues that I mentioned earlier in the call. So issues regarding transparency regarding statistics and private sector compliance with government requests for national security information, that information is now in the public domain because the private sector demanded it and basically was going to litigate the government if the government did not facilitate companies releasing that information. So in that context, I think external stakeholders played an absolutely pivotal role in advancing the cause of transparency in this area, not only on the statistics issue, which was ended up being able to be negotiated, but also on the provisions that were added into law regarding transparency. The private sector and the advocacy organizations played a substantial role in working on facilitating more transparency provisions being written into law.
Thank you. LaToya, do we have another question?
Hey, your next question comes from the line of Gina McLaughlin.
Hi, this is Jenna.
Go ahead.
Can you hear me? Great. Thank you so much. I'm a reporter with The Intercept. It's an online news website. Thank you both so much for doing this. I really appreciate it, and I think this has been really interesting. My question is just a really short follow-up to the discussion about the process of sort of trying to determine some sort of estimate about how many Americans' communications are involved in Section 702 collection, incidental collection. And I just was wondering, I've heard sort of back and forth from different people that there are some sort of timeline estimates, but they're fuzzy. So I was just wondering if Alex had any vague or concrete timeline estimates on when the DNI plans on releasing any sort of estimate on those numbers.
Hi, Jenna. Now, unfortunately, I don't have a specific timeline. We are working on it. It's a priority. We've been talking to various folks about it. We have another session scheduled with civil society to follow up and have another discussion with them. We are, you know, we're trying to figure out a way to do this. If it was easy, we would have done it, hopefully, by now, although you can't ever guarantee anything with how government bureaucracy works. But we are, I regret, I don't have a specific timeline. We understand it's a priority. We understand a lot of folks have been asking these questions, including up on the Hill. So I know that people are working hard on it. And as I said, we have a meeting coming up where we're going to further discuss it and hopefully find a way forward. One of the challenges we have is that if we simply just pick a way to do this ourselves, just so that we can get it done and get moving, and it turns out that when we discuss it more broadly with folks, they don't find that method satisfying in the least, or, you know, they reject the method, then we will have committed the bureaucracy toward a particular approach, and it'll be harder to reverse course. So we really want to make sure we have some basic engagement with people and figure out a way forward that makes sense. And so that's what we're working on right now.
Thanks.
Let me ask, I see no other questions on the line unless, LaToya, you tell me otherwise, but let me ask one final question. I'll ask, start with Alex, and Carrie can chime in if you'd like. How would you grade yourself on satisfying calls for transparency? I mean, you've made efforts. There have been a lot of calls. You've made some efforts. How do you think you're doing?
Well, I learned from high school when I had when our physics teacher asked us to grade ourselves, I gave myself a B, and then he ended up giving everybody the grade that they graded themselves, including my goof-off friends who graded themselves A's. So I'm going to pass on the invitation to actually grade myself on this. I will say that we have worked extremely hard, and that work's been recognized by different folks. You know, we received some positive feedback from civil society regarding our efforts. They do want us to do more. They want us to really make this something that's lasting. They want us to dig in on their issues, and on that score, we have, you know, still more work to do. I will say one more thing. One of the challenges that we face is that no transparency is ever enough. It's really not a destination, it's a journey. So we have to, you know, every time we provide information, it inevitably leads to additional questions and requests for more specifics and more information. That's just the way human nature is. That's the way the human mind works. And so I think part of our process is to understand that, embrace it, accept it. We aren't going to reach a point in time where we will have provided the ideal amount of transparency and everybody can go home and go back to work as usual. This is going to have to be an ongoing process and part of what it means to be an intelligence professional.
Thank you, Carrie. In the 1 minute we have left, anything you'd like to add there?
Great. Yeah, I'll just add that I think the next phase of transparency and where the government and the intelligence community are going to go on this is in two areas. And one that would be classification reform, reform of the classification system, which would assist these transparency efforts if the government can make progress on reforming the system of classification. And two, efforts to revise, update, modernize, however you want to describe it, with respect to the FOIA process. I think moving this sort of the more granular transparency that the intelligence community has been dealing with more recently into these broader areas that will have longer term consequences would sort of be the next phase.
Right. Thank you. I see that it's 4 o'clock, at least on my clock. So thank you very much to Alex Joel and Carrie Cordero for the discussion this afternoon. LaToya, I'll hand it back to you.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to the American Bar Association for permission to use this audio. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, please spread the word and promote the Lawfare podcast via your social networks, Twitter, Facebook, email, and in any way you can. Thanks for listening.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.